Former Labor Secretary Robert Reich says of all the developed nations, the U.S. has the most unequal distribution of income, and it's getting worse. This hour, Reich tells us why that's a problem. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Time magazine named Robert Reich one of the 10 most effective cabinet secretaries of the 20th century. He's authored 13 books, including the bestsellers Aftershock and The Work of Nations. His new film, Inequality for All, is now in theaters. We'll talk with him about that. Then we'll be joined by two Iowa sociologists and an Iowa economist to find out how income distribution is changing in Iowa and why it matters. Former Labor Secretary Robert Reich, live. After this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and my guest in this first half hour is economist and author Robert Reich. Reich was the Secretary of Labor under President Bill Clinton. Time magazine named him one of the 10 most effective cabinet secretaries of the 20th century. Currently, he's Chancellor's Professor of Public Policy at the University of California, Berkeley. He's the author of 13 books, including the bestsellers Aftershock and The Work of Nations. He has a new film out. It's called Inequality for All, now showing in theaters, including a public viewing tonight in Iowa City in McBride Auditorium on the University of Iowa campus at 7 p.m., 7 to 9 p.m., followed by a panel discussion, which I will be moderating as well. Let's get a little taste of the film. Here's a sample of the audio from the film's trailer.
1928 and 2007 become the peak years for income concentration. It looks like a suspension bridge.
Last year, we made $36,000.
I probably make $50,000 a year, working 70 hours a week.
The middle class is struggling.
People occasionally say to me, what nation does it better? The answer is the United States.
In the decades after World War II, the economy boomed, but you had very low inequality.
Inequality for All, the film now showing in theaters, including in Iowa City tonight. Robert Reich joins us live by phone. Robert Reich, Secretary Reich, welcome.
Well, thank you, Ben.
Welcome back to the program. So give us a big picture. We heard a short clip of the film there, but broad brush strokes, what's the problem you see?
Well, the problem is not just that almost all the economic gains are going to a very small group at the top. It's also that that degree of inequality, which we haven't seen by some measures in over 100 years, is holding the entire economy back. The one reason that we have such a sluggish and anemic recovery is because the vast middle class and the poor don't have enough money to keep the economy going. Because 95% of all of the gains since the recovery began have gone to the top 1%. It's also bad for our democracy because it means that a handful of people have the money to essentially undermine and corrupt our democracy, particularly after Citizens United against the Federal Election Commission, I think shameful Supreme Court decision.
Mm-hmm. So tell me a little bit about the approach you take in this film to grasp those challenges there.
Well, what we do in the film is to look at 2 years where inequality was the greatest over the last 100 years, where the top 1% was getting over 23% of total income. Those 2 years were 1928 and 2007. And then explore why it was in the following years, 1929 and 2008, the economy crashed. Was there any relationship at all? And the answer, I hope, becomes obvious, and that obvious answer is yes. When equality becomes too much, when the economy gets too top-heavy, it simply cannot function.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And this is bad for everyone. The reason we named it Economy for All, Ben, is it's not a tirade against the rich. It's not a progressive or lefty-oriented film. It really is making the case that even the rich would do better with a smaller share of a rapidly growing economy than they're doing right now with a big share of one that is almost dead in the water.
Robert Reich, make the case a little bit more convincing to me with a little more detail. When you say 1927 and then the crash following that in 2007, then the crash following that,
that doesn't necessarily mean one caused the other because they coincided. So tell what is the cause?
Yeah, the actual years preceding the great crash of 1929 and the smaller crash of 2008 showed remarkably similar patterns. For one thing, inequality grew. The rich took a larger and larger share of total income. Secondly, the middle class and the poor, in order to maintain their standard of living, went deeper and deeper into debt in both periods, in the 20s and also in the years leading up to the crash of 2008. Those debt bubbles eventually burst. The rich, having more and more and more of the national income, they tended to gamble in stocks, in commodities, in real estate, and those debts and that gambling, that speculation also blew up in 1929 and 2008. We also see, a degree in both periods of political corruption. That is, the rich have more and more political power. They can keep taxes down. They are able to basically call the shots on Wall Street. Wall Street is deregulated. Wall Street gets out of control. Both periods are eerily similar.
Mm-hmm. When you talk about the rich corrupting the political system, we had Citizens United, you mentioned as well. We have Supreme Court justices. How does a ultra-rich class then corrupt nine justices on the bench?
Well, not directly the nine justices, unless you take a conspiratorial view of the Republicans on the bench, which I don't. Some people do. But it's more indirect. That is, it is more difficult to maintain campaign finance laws. The loopholes get larger and larger. The amount of money in politics among lobbyists and among public relations professionals that are doing the bidding of big corporations and the wealthy gets greater and greater. Washington becomes a very rich city off of all of the money pouring into it, mostly by big corporations, Wall Street, trade associations, and the very rich, seeking favors, seeking special tax breaks, seeking corporate welfare, seeking special subsidies. And you have entire industries like Wall Street, oil and gas, insurance, big oil, but also big agriculture, even there in Iowa. Mm-hmm. That are getting special favors because they have so much money.
To what extent is so much money concentrated
in so few hands?
Mm-hmm. To what extent do you see the trends that you're talking about represented in agriculture? Iowa represents agriculture more than any other state?
Well, what we see is that agricultural subsidies that go mainly to very, very wealthy. I mean, I'm sure that there are family farmers, small farmers that benefit. But most of those agricultural subsidies have been shown to go to a relative small group of extremely wealthy agribusinesses and farmers. At the same time, you have tariffs on certain agricultural goods. All of this tends to push up the price of certain agricultural goods for average working people and the poor. At the same time, the Congress just passes a bill, or is very close to passing a bill, that will reduce food stamps for the poor while providing agricultural benefits.
But doesn't it also, the farm bill, doesn't it also reduce subsidies for farmers as well?
It does. It does. And I think it's a step in the right direction. But nevertheless, there's a lot of money there, Ben. I mean, I don't want to criticize anybody. This is the way the game is played. And one of the things that we do in the movie is not try to vilify anybody or villainize anybody. We look at the system as a whole, and it's very important, I think, and the reason that we made the movie, and the movie comes very much out of a recent book that I wrote called Aftershock, The Next Economy in America's Future, is that it's if you start vilifying people, if you start blaming the rich or the poor or immigrants or government or unions or big corporations, regardless of who you blame, that process of blaming takes your eye off the big reality, which is that the system itself is now outdated, outmoded. It's not working for most people. And again, everybody would be better off if we didn't have the degree of inequality we now have.
Economist and author Robert Reich is with us for this first half hour talking about income distribution, the inequality that he represents in his new film, Inequality for All, now in theaters, showing tonight in Iowa City. And Robert Reich, former Secretary of Labor under Bill Clinton, how do we compare with other wealthy industrialized countries in terms of distribution of wealth, of income, Robert Reich? Do others have a better, broader base?
Well, other rich countries, in fact, most other developing countries as well, if they're on the kind of top half of the developing country scale, they have a greater degree of equality than we do. We are the outliers. We are the most unequal distribution of income of all rich nations and of many developing nations. We're sort of off the scales. Now, having said that, let me make sure that listeners understand that almost every country is moving in our direction. That is, inequality is growing. Even in China, in Japan, which has a tradition of a much broader base of prosperity and more egalitarian policies. And inequality is growing everywhere for the same basic reasons. Globalization, technological change are awarding those who are well-educated and well-connected and penalizing those who aren't. But other countries are doing more about it. They're doing more like what we did in the 1950s, 60s, and early 70s, when we had a high marginal tax rate on the very wealthy, when we used that to pour money into education, including public higher education. We built roads and bridges, upgraded our infrastructure. We also kept careful regulation of our financial sector. And we had a large unionized sector. Over 35% of Americans were unionized in the 1950s, and this meant that they had the bargaining power to get a fairly substantial share of the benefits of economic growth.
Mm-hmm. I hear you discussing a few of the proposed fixes you have. You have about a half dozen fixes there, a couple of them you mentioned. Raising the minimum wage has been a hot-button issue for several years in Washington and across the country. You mentioned raising the minimum wage to someone in politics, and they'll say, well, let's see how many jobs I have to get rid of if you raise the wage to $9 or $10. Right?
That's what some people say. But actually, the evidence points to the fact that when you have as much slack as we do now in the economy, when you raise the minimum wage, you're actually putting more money into people's pockets. They can turn around and buy more, which means that actually, instead of reducing jobs, you're increasing jobs.
What about, though, the people who are let go because now the manager is saying, I have to pay my people at least $10 an hour when I had people perfectly willing to work for $8 an hour.
Well, not that many people would be let go for the simple reason that you managers would discover that they have less turnover. In fact, the former head of the Council of Economic Advisers, Alan Krueger, under Obama, did a study several years ago in which he found that a higher minimum wage, New Jersey at that time had a higher minimum wage than the federal minimum wage, relative to Pennsylvania. And he looked at fast food restaurants on both sides of the same river, dividing Pennsylvania from New Jersey. So there was a bridge connecting the two, found that actually there was better job growth in New Jersey with a higher minimum wage in fast food restaurants than in Pennsylvania. Why? Well, he speculated that it was because there was less turnover. More people came into the job market and employers had greater choice of of who they hired.
So where is the sweet spot? Why not raise it to $50 or $100 an hour just to be ridiculous?
Well, because obviously at some point you're going to actually have negative employment growth. You're actually going to lose jobs. But if we simply had kept the minimum wage what it was in 1968, adjusting for inflation from 1968, today it would be over $10.40.
Mm-hmm. You also talk in your proposed fixes here in about strengthening workers' voices. We saw a lot of that happening, especially in Wisconsin, was sort of the epicenter of that. How do you interpret what happened in Wisconsin and who came out on top?
Well, I view that as a loss for organized labor in Wisconsin. And the problem is if you lose organized labor, you lose not only a voice for workers, but you lose the bargaining power that workers need and they had in the 1950s and 60s to get a fair share of the benefits of economic growth. I mean, Ben, there is a reason why 95% of the economic gains since 2009, since the recovery began, have gone to the top 1%. Why the rest of the 99% of Americans are sharing only 5% of the economic gains since 2009. One of the big reasons is, you know, most Americans don't have any bargaining power with employers, with the captains of industry, with those who are actually pocketing most of the economic benefits. And this is not an attack. Again, I want you to understand, this is not an attack on the rich, because I'm not saying they're bad people. I'm simply saying the way we've organized ourselves, particularly with regard to reducing unionization as radically and dramatically as we have, has contributed to the kind of inequality that is holding back the entire economy.
We talk a lot about campaign finance on this program. It's an issue that seems to have no solution, but I wonder what you thought would be the solution to getting big money out of politics. How do you do that when those in power have that big money to thank for their positions?
Well, the other hat I wear is a chairman of a citizens group called Common Cause. And Common Cause has been in the forefront for 40 years of trying to get big money out of politics. Sometimes it wins, sometimes it loses. It's now not winning, because big money is now engulfing our political system. But there are periods of time when reform does work. We had for a limited period of time McCain-Feingold. Their act, John McCain, Russ Feingold, did help hold back the torrent of money. We could have public campaign funding right now, even after Citizens United. We could say, you know, Congress could pass a law. Now, whether Congress would is another question, but Congress could pass a law, even with a Supreme Court decision in Citizens United. And that law would say that for example, every $2 raised from a small donor, that the government would provide $1 to a candidate that has that is in a primary election. Now, that kind of public financing, that matching fund, might even up the playing field.
Mm-hmm. We just had a Tea Party revolt stemming out of our 2008 economic crash, nearly worldwide crash. That Tea Party revolt in this country resonated with the message, get government out of our lives, shrink the government, the bloated bureaucracies. Now, we're supposed to believe that people will rise up and demand more government because who else is going to do this? Government intervening to correct a widening income gap?
I don't think the issue is more or less government. I think the real question is who is government for? Government could be smaller, much smaller, and still make major investments in education and job training and some of the things we've talked about already if it were not doing so many of the things it should not be doing in terms of providing subsidies to military contractors, oil and gas, some of the other
farmers
big
in
industries
Iowa.
That we farmers in Iowa, some of the others we've talked about. Also, you know, there is a great deal of loophole. You know, you have Wall Street private equity managers and hedge fund managers who are taking advantage of something called a carried interest loophole, which enables them to treat their income as capital gains and pay the capital gains, much lower preferred capital gains rate, even though they're not investing their own money. You know, it's a loophole that we've had on the books for years, and it's just one of many, many loopholes that the wealthy and large corporations, not small corporations, not small businesses, large corporations have got into the tax code in order to protect their positions, to entrench their wealth. and their power. Well, if you get rid of these kinds of loopholes, you also free money up for education and for infrastructure and for a lot of the other things we need to do.
We have about 5 minutes left with Robert Reich. Let's take a quick call from John in Waterloo. Hi, John. Have to make it quick, but please share with us your thought, your question.
It's my understanding there's been an excess labor supply since 1978, and that unions probably diminished their power because of an excess labor supply. And then I would also say, is there a production purpose rather than consumption, but for like a space economy?
John, there are a lot of jobs that could be used. I didn't get your last word, but for a kind of green economy, for moving from carbon-based to a non-carbon-based fuel economy. And in terms of an abundance of labor, when I was labor secretary in the middle 1990s, there was a huge surge in employment, 22 million net new jobs created during the Clinton administration, largely because the economy was growing, because we were investing, not as much as we should have, but we were nevertheless investing in infrastructure, in education, in helping people do better in a variety of ways. And at the same time, it wasn't a tax cut. In fact, taxes increased under the Clinton administration. But nevertheless, the direction that we all moved in was to enlarge the economy and create more jobs. That can be done again. There's no reason we can't. And we moved toward greater equality in the Clinton administration.
Mm-hmm. Let's briefly touch in the 2 minutes we have left, Robert Reich. How do you think these themes, income inequality, this disparity you point out in this film, will shape 2014 and 2016 elections?
Well, I think they'll become quite central. Bill de Blasio's election in New York is not going to be unique. More and more candidates are going to be responding to the anxieties and concerns of a vast middle class and poor who are seeing that not only are the dice loaded against them, but they're loaded against the entire economy and our democracy. You know, Iowa, because of where you are in the electoral primary cycle, you have a tremendous opportunity and also a tremendous responsibility to make sure that candidates in 2016 of both parties put inequality, widening inequality, directly in the center, because there is no major domestic issue in the United States that is more important.
Okay. Are you asking of any other action by Iowans, those listening?
Well, that's the most important thing that Iowa can do. That is the opportunity and responsibility of Iowa. But it is especially acute right now when we're seeing record levels of inequality.
Just a few seconds left, but what if people agree with what you're saying? They've heard you and they just say, you know, it's too overwhelming. I can't imagine the type of change happening being described. Our system's so entrenched, big money. The changes you're suggesting are pie-in-the-sky utopia. What do you say to that?
They aren't. In the progressive era, in between 1901 and 1916, in the 1930s, in the 1960s, with civil rights, voting rights, Medicare, Medicaid, we have done this before. We've saved capitalism from its own excesses. And that kind of thinking is a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you give up on politics, you're giving up on democracy. And if you give up on democracy, you are basically ceding the entire game to the moneyed interests.
Economist and author Robert Reich, former Secretary of Labor under Bill Clinton. Robert Reich, always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Ben.
Coming up after a short break, we'll talk with two sociologists from Iowa, also an economist, to talk a little bit about the ideas that Robert Reich deals with in his new film, Inequality for All. I want to have your input, your questions. Do you see a growing gap between the haves and the have-nots? Does it matter to you? Are you energized by what Robert Reich says? Perhaps you see some chinks in the arguments. 1-866-780-9100. Back in just a moment with more of River to River. More of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We were talking this first half hour with Robert Reich, the former Secretary of Labor under Bill Clinton. He has a new film out, Inequality for All, now in theaters. In fact, you can see that tonight in Iowa City. At 7 p.m. at McBride Hall, we'll also be having a panel discussion after the film to talk about some of the themes there. And joining me this half hour to discuss income distribution, inequality, as Robert Reich puts it. Sarah Brooke is with us, assistant professor of sociology at the University of Iowa, also of the University of Iowa in our Iowa City studio. Kevin Light, director of the Iowa Social Science Research Center and professor in the Department of Sociology. Sarah and Kevin, welcome.
Thanks.
Thanks, Ben.
And Dave Swenson is with us in Des Moines, associate scientist in the Department of Economics at Iowa State University. Our economist, Dave Swenson, welcome to you.
Thank you.
Tell us, let's start with the hard economic facts and figures here. You were listening to Robert Reich. Anything there that is disputed by anybody about the widening gap between the incomes and the distribution of wealth in this country compared to other countries and in our history?
Well, no. He's got the general trends right. He pointed out that we had two major peaks in the concentration of income among our wealthiest citizens in 1928 and 2007. And that in and of itself is what they're paying attention to. But he also talked about the accumulation of net gains over the course of this recovery and how gains have not trickled down or otherwise allocated themselves down to the lower, let's say, 95% of the population. Now, the point of this concentration of wealth and income in a smaller and smaller component of overall society, that's the worrisome part of it. It's not necessarily that we don't have adequate incomes. It's that we don't have enough people with adequate access to the kind of consumption and overall household standards of living to maintain a growing and healthy economy. If one aspect of the economy is concentrating its wealth, ours is an economy that's driven off of consumption.
Just to make sure that I'm clear with this, Dave Swenson, is that if you didn't have so much wealth at the very, very top and you could put that down into the middle class more, you'd say they would be spending more on durable goods and so forth. Don't the wealthy do something with their wealth that spurs the economy as well?
Yeah, they do. They are really, really good at spending money. But the money that they spend isn't necessarily the kind of spending that produces the range of goods and services demand in the United States that turns around and employs people to produce those goods and services. What we want in this country, it's a social problem more so than an economic problem. We need some notion of equal opportunity to achieve. And if that is constrained by not enough money and not enough social resources for certain groups of people to, by merit and by hard work, earn their way up into the middle classes, if we have such a maldistribution of resources that prevents that, it actually leads to either a slower growing economy or just long-term stagnation and polarization. So it's not just an economic issue. It's social mobility, political mobility, and political civic engagement. And then ultimately, it's your overall lifetime opportunities for achievement.
Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Let's turn to our sociologists, Kevin Light. Talk about the ideas that Robert Reich launched into there and how you see them affecting society when we have this income distribution with a wide gap in the middle.
Well, sort of to echo Dave's point about this being a social problem, I think the biggest day-to-day problem that results from this is that we lose a prevailing narrative about how people get ahead. So if we go back to the 1960s and 1970s and things, our parents told us, so I think Ben's about my age, and we'll leave Sarah out of this for now. You know, the types of things parents told you to do to get ahead that would put you on the map and put you on the way toward prosperity were fairly reliable things that worked. It's not completely clear in an environment that deprives people of opportunity like we have now what the narrative actually is.
So how are we deprived of opportunity, whereas when let's say Kevin you know, when we were kids, we were, let's say we were not deprived of opportunity. What isn't there now for young people in their teens that was there when we were in our teens?
Well, consistent access to high-quality education and higher education at a modest cost is a big issue that's affecting opportunity. There are fewer and fewer ways to systematically learn a trade than there once was. So the non-college bound portion of the high school population is not being trained to do very much, at least systematically. And these – so education itself has become to a substantial extent something that the wealthy and the near wealthy can take advantage of, and something that most members of the middle class have a very difficult time with getting access to and taking advantage of.
Mm-hmm. Sarah Brooke, I understand you teach a segment on income inequality in your class. What class is that at the University of Iowa?
It's called Poverty, Inequality, and Public Policy.
Mm-hmm. So how do you portray it? How do you give people the picture of what the United States represents in these terms?
The way I describe income inequality to the students in my class is I tell them that you can focus on the overall story of the trends that Reich was talking about, but you can also break it down to look at what's going on with the people at the bottom versus people in the middle versus what's going on with the top. And those are really three different stories that all contribute to the rise in overall income inequality. So the most common story for people to be aware of is what's going on at the top, which is the top is taking off. And so a lot of the solutions that we come up with have to do with what's going on at the top. But another really important part of the story is what's going on at the bottom in the middle. And some of the things that Kevin and Dave were talking about also are about what do we do about the middle. And a lot of that has to do with jobs and their wages and their level of opportunity to do the things that they want to do.
Mm-hmm. What do you see as happening to the middle and the implications that we can witness? With someone out there saying, well, my life hasn't changed very much over the last couple of decades.
I would say the fact that your life hasn't changed that much when other people are doing extremely well might be seen as problematic. I mean, there's a couple of reasons why we would care about inequality, and it's not just about what happens with us personally. Part of it are, you know, is what's going on in terms of the distribution of resources something that's equitable or fair, or does it go along with some of the other normative considerations that we have? But we might also just care for instrumental reasons. We might think that inequality has a negative consequence for you know, not just things like mobility, but also the economy in terms of economic growth, and also social and political things.
Mm-hmm. Dave Swenson, as an economist, do you look at how Robert Reich talks about the politics, the inequity in economic terms, having a big connection to politics? Do you look at that as well?
Yes. Well, you pay attention to it in two dimensions. First of all, just what is the distribution of resources and how are those resources used? But second, normatively, we also look at, well, how does government play a role in either modifying the market or modifying these distributions of resources? And is the role that government is playing adequate? So we would pay attention, for example, to social assistance programs, nutrition assistance programs, the types of things that redistribute resources, usually via a progressive income tax, where the wealthy are taxed at a higher rate than the middle or the lower income earners. And you're using society's resources to, for a purpose, redirect those resources to benefit and or try to equal the playing field to achieve both within group as well as across group mobility. And I would also add, and this is very important, I think, when we think in terms of rural development, geographic mobility, to be able to go from a poor place in Mississippi to an urban area in Mississippi and be able to thrive, or to be able to go from rural South Dakota, where I'm from, to Des Moines, Iowa, mm-hmm. and to be able to achieve. And so we have all levels of mobility that can be hindered as a consequence of having immobility that's associated with a concentration of wealth.
Kevin Light, what do you make of, and I raise this point with Robert Reich too, the Tea Party revolt that we had starting in 2008. There are people, not what we generally think of as the wealthiest segment in the United States, saying government off our back, and what we're talking about right now is proposing sort of an intervention. If we talk about progressive politics, more government to correct what is perceived as income inequality. Explain these people to me that yearn for less government when you would think, if we're believing what we're hearing, that they should actually want more government to even it out for distribution of wealth.
Well, I actually think the Tea Party and Occupy Wall Street are two sides of the same phenomenon. And what the Tea Party actually represents is a demonstration of a lack of confidence in what government can do. And if you look actually at the track record of what the federal government in particular has done since the late 70s and the early 1980s, some of the Tea Party claims about will government help average people like me are justified. Those concerns are justified. There's a lot of evidence that wealthy people have disproportionate influence on how the government works. Government isn't going to help people like me, isn't going to give me a tax cut. Why should there be all of these bailouts of big industries and Wall Street and industries that are too big to fail when the average person gets nothing? And so there's a kernel of the Tea Party questioning that is actually, you could argue some of the solutions they talk about may be less than adaptive, but they are identifying a problem that's common with the problem that Occupy Wall Street identifies.
John is joining us by phone from Washington. Thanks for calling 1-866-780-9100. Hi, John, in Washington, Iowa, I assume.
Hello. On your, I think it was on your very program, but on this station, it's the only station I listen to, Rand Paul ignored the middle class. He kept constantly referring to a working class and a business class. There were only two classes. And it goes right along with, you know, the top 1%. And I'd like your people to respond to that, please.
Okay, who would like to tackle that? Kevin and
I,
yeah? Okay, we'll go to Dave Swanson in a moment. But Kevin, first of all, yeah.
That's a very interesting political strategy that I think is very close or is very akin to the strategy among some politicians of saying that any discussion of class at all amounts to saying that there's class warfare. So one of the ways of sidestepping whether or not your policies help the middle class is to basically claim there isn't one. And this is simply a rhetorical device for doing that. Well, there's God-fearing working class people we're helping, and there's a business class group that employs them, which sounds strangely like Marxism if you go back and read Karl Marx's writings. So I think it's a rhetorical device.
Dave Swanson, in reaction to that?
Sure. Well, first of all, we in the United States really don't have class consciousness. It's very muddled between what constitutes our middle class and not like maybe what would exist in Great Britain, who folks know full well whether they come from working class stock, middle class stock, or the upper echelons. And the range of what constitutes the rhetorical middle class in the United States is absolutely phenomenal. You might ask somebody, a household that's making at best maybe $40,000 a year, do they think that they're middle class? And oftentimes they might say yes. And yet people making, you know, 8, 9, 10 times that much annually would also identify themselves as middle class when, in fact, they're in the upper 10% or so. So we don't have a good sense of where we fit in to that economic continuum. And as a consequence, I think as Kevin just said, rhetorical flourishes like that or rhetorical tricks are basically useful in politics.
Sarah Brooke.
I also think it's important to go back to what Reich was saying at the beginning, too, that just to speak back to what you raised, Ben, with, you know, whether or not everything that we're advocating here is more government as opposed to less government, and whether this is really a partisan issue about more and less government versus whether it's just trying to make it so that we don't have anything like a pure competitive market economy apart from laws and regulations and things that governments do to make these things fair. What I think the point is really to make – and sort of the point of democracy is to make it so that our institutions, our market institutions and our public institutions actually operate in a way that are consistent with our values as a society.
Mm-hmm. But in this time, in this political reality when many of us, regardless of political party, don't have a lot of faith in government. Is there a way to, Dave Swenson, for instance, redirect resources if we agree that having so much wealth at the top end is not a good thing for anybody? Can you redirect resources without the government being involved?
Not very effectively. It's pretty hard to do without outright robbery. You really do have to have the coercive power of the state. The state uses its tax policy. The state perhaps uses, when I say state, I mean the government. The state may use its investment policy. We've had cycles of the state using its ability to try to equalize opportunities. It had to happen during the Great Depression, during the recovery programs of the Great Depression. We also see it during the Great Society years of the 1960s when we broadly expanded the nation's social assistance program to try to extend opportunities into inner cities and out into Appalachia rural areas to try to equalize, again, opportunities. It usually requires a significant and targeted amount of public resources to, over the long haul, correct a maldistribution of resources and opportunity.
So redirect wealth is redistribution of wealth.
In general, you want to maybe slow the accumulation of wealth among the top and create opportunities for actual accumulation of wealth and or income among the other classes of income earners in the United States. And it sounds like a zero-sum gain, but if somebody is disproportionately benefiting at the expense of the rest of society, society has an obligation to see what it can't do to correct that such that more people have opportunities, again, to achieve household incomes and to maintain their lifetime mobility.
Sarah Brooke?
I think that when we keep talking about redistribution, we also have to keep in mind that many of the solutions that we're talking about actually work on the front end in terms of how our institutions are structured and how they distribute the income to start with, as opposed to another set of policies or things that we could do which are on the back end, which are about what do you do once people leave the labor market or they don't enter the labor market. And then that's the redistribution sort of function that we're talking about now.
We have just a few minutes left. I'd like to get your takes on what you see as we move forward. Do you see any sort of realistic prospect of reaching some of the things that Robert Reich talked about in terms of making a correction here if we believe this is not a good thing? Dave Swenson?
Well, I'm hopeful and I'm pessimistic. At the same time, we have an extraordinarily slow recovery. That means that the benefits of this recovery accumulating to the average wage and salary earner, the average household, those benefits really aren't accumulating very rapidly. And so that part makes me pessimistic. However, if this economy, if it over time starts to pick up, if it starts to expand, if consumption increases, if we get a virtual cycle of production and consumption, it could very well be that we see some of the concentrations reverse themselves and redistribute just through the market back into households. And that part I'm hopeful for.
Kevin Light?
I guess I'm a little bit less hopeful than Dave is, only because we have such stratospheric levels of income and wealth inequality that what we've done is we've created a society or nation where substantial percentages of people at the top aren't really in this together with the rest of us, and they can buy their way out of most social problems the rest of us have to deal with. So they can move into neighborhoods with private security forces. They can send their children to very expensive private schools and don't have to pay for public schools. They can move labor to places in the world where they don't have to pay people very much money. So what is being lost that I'm afraid we're having trouble getting back is the there but for the grace of God go I issue that sort of holds, or the glue that holds our society together.
So we have this kind of locked in aristocracy protecting itself that's disconnected from the well-being of the bulk of Americans.
Yes, and they pass their wealth on to the next generation, which often did nothing to earn it in the first place. So they have it by mere fortune of birth.
Mm-hmm. Sarah Brooke, are you as pessimistic as Kevin Light, your colleague there?
I am pessimistic about some things, but I'm generally an optimist and I look on the bright side of things. One of the things that I find most optimistic is I really think that this film, the Inequality for All film, and also things that are going on now with the Occupy movement really seeks to inform people. And what people are doing now that I find more optimistic is that they're coming to understand how the system is structured and what's going on, such as income inequality. And when people come to understand what's going on, I think that that really does activate a large segment of the population to stay informed and to make their voices heard. And so I'm a more optimistic person in terms of people participating and being part of the
system. We don't hear much from the Occupy movement anymore. It's certainly not in the news. So they might as well have disappeared or not. Am I not keeping up?
No, I'm not sure that it matters what they're doing currently. What they did was they raised this issue to the public awareness in a way that now when students come in my class, I don't have to say, do you know what income inequality is? We started a different point now because they have a general awareness that this is in the public discourse that was not present, I think, before.
Okay, very good. We'll leave it there. Thank you very much for joining us, the three of you. Sarah Brook, Assistant Professor of Sociology at the University of Iowa. Kevin Light, Director of the Iowa Social Science Research Center and professor in the Department of Sociology at the University of Iowa. Dave Swenson in Des Moines, Associate Scientist in the Department of Economics at Iowa State University. Dave, Kevin, Sarah, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
Thanks for having us on.
Thank you.
I want to thank Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton, along with Dennis Reese, for helping behind the scenes make this program work. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Tune in tomorrow, Politics Day. We'll find out what's in store. I guess I don't have a good clue on what's in store. We'll find out tomorrow, Politics Day. Tune in over the noon hour. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.